I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa.
Hello, hello, Vashon Island. My name is Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies, a travel story show. As we all have to now reminisce about past travel in these days of COVID. And today we have Afel Damon, a dear friend and fellow traveler. He and his family lived for many years on Vashon Island, but they have resided in D.C. now for about 8 years, and we miss them terribly. And Afel has taken the time today to write a few stories for us about his past experiences of travel. And thankfully for the four of us, myself, Adam, Afel, and his wife Agatha, we got to take a huge trip together a couple years ago, and I am so grateful for those memories. Not that he's going to read stories about that, but I'm just glad that we got to have any travel in together. Afel, how are you, my dear?
I'm good. How are you, Megan?
Good. And he is calling in from D.C., so if it sounds a little funny, you know why. Are you missing Vashon these days at all? Do you guys miss it? Yeah.
Yeah, we miss it a lot. We loved it there, and it's just remarkable that we've been away for so long. But life deals you cards.
So I know. It does.
Where we are.
It's got to be so different to be like in a city center versus the pastoral island.
Yeah. It's a very different atmosphere and culture here. I mean, of course, it's very diverse, but at the same time, the overall sentiment, I would say, has much more career-driven than anything else, and that kind of
You can
pervasive.
Feel it when you're there.
Yeah.
Yeah, you definitely can. I mean, but at the end of the day, Afel, we all know that the West Coast is the best coast. Just joking. I like the East Coast too. All right, so Afel, you have a couple stories for us, and I am going to ask you to start reading one of them for us, please.
All right. Well, this is my first one. Thank you.
Thank you.
We spent weeks planning, probably more like months, but at 18, it was important. Our parents brought us to the airport where we boarded an international flight with a smoking section. I didn't care about smoking, but it excited me, so I smoked. I remember we also had Drambuie. I have no clear idea as to why we chose this. I guess it seemed sophisticated to a couple of 18-year-old boys going to Europe on a Boeing 747. I remember the flight not being very exciting, not being able to sleep much, and generally wondering why it felt so great. Ben, Pete, and I. Pete was part English, so his was returning to his haunts. Ben and I, we were starting out in London. Ben was going to take a side trip up to Irish relatives. I was going to couch surf with Pete. Then Ben and I would head to Norway because our friend Paul was there and Europe is small. And then somehow we were going to end up in Vienna and then back to Paris and home to Michigan, but first London. We arrived and parted ways, Pete off to somewhere to call us once we had all slept. Ben and I went to his aunt's somewhere in Clapham. I looked at its description just now when we were there. It was much more working class, tiny houses and quaint streets. Ben and I met his aunt. She ushered us in, gave us a quick rundown of where things were, and went off to work. We tried to sleep. I woke up somewhere midday, found tea and maybe some sort of snack she had left us. I remember being insanely hungry. Also, Ben slept. I walked outside and there was nothing but houses. I went in and turned on the TV. There were about three channels, news and cricket. For something like 3 hours, I tried to figure out what the hell was going on in that cricket game. I found an oil can of awful beer and it became funny. There they were in whites, and a score that indicated a lot of something was happening. But as far as I could tell, nothing was happening, and there was no reason for scores to go up or people to change positions, but all did. Finally, Pete called us. We used a map, coordinated a time, and met him at some friend's flat where we watched Blackadder for many hours and smoked hash. This was a brilliant way to get rid of jet lag. Stoned and hungry, we left the house in a haze. I remember one clear moment. For reasons long or instantly forgotten, we needed to take a train and not the tube, and whatever station we were at allowed for us to switch, but we would have to pay something that none of us or most of us didn't have or felt wasn't justified. Pete knew a way. It was a relatively open-air station, not underground. We walked out the back, jumped off the platform, followed the tracks to a fence with a break in it. We walked through it, down a path of sorts. Apparently, we were not the only people to do this, and then approached the train area. We had to make sure no trains were coming. They weren't. Then we had to hop the tracks. The train had a third rail, and we were laughing. At least four of us. Pete, a friend of his, Ben, and I, maybe another or two. I remember hopping up on the train platform, kind of transfixed by the third rail and how dangerous and simple it was, and ultimately easy to avoid. We were all laughing about stuff. I looked, and Ben hadn't caught up with us. A future tiger trainer and firefighter. He was so spacey and slow sometimes. I looked back, and here he came loping along. He waved, took a step, and jumped so that in stride he went into the air, put his foot down on the third rail to propel him further. Everything froze. We yelled, and he landed on the platform, perplexed. "What?" he said. "I have no real clue why we didn't have to call his mom and tell her that we had been in London for less than 24 hours and managed to kill her son in order to avoid a pound or two in cost. But we didn't."
London's burning! London's burning!
FL, I have to tell you that the first time I read that story, it reminded me so much of my own sort of crazy antics in like during travel, and I laughed and wanted to throw up at the same time.
there's another part of that trip that is so amazing that just burned into my head, where we were in somebody's, I don't know, it wasn't a Jeep. It was something like a Jeep, but European. And we were flying down this road at night, and we ended up at a jazz club that you needed to know a secret knock.
Uh-huh.
And it was called the 666 Club. And it was incredible. Like all these old jazz players and like food and people.
And it was in London.
It was in London.
Oh my God. That sounds so amazing.
Yeah.
You know, when you describe your first, your first big flight, you know, leaving from the States to go over to Europe for the first time. Like, I remember that excitement so much, and you describe it so beautifully with, like, the Drambuie. I mean, why would you pick Drambuie?
I have no idea. I don't like it now. I probably didn't like it then.
Yeah, well, you're probably not sophisticated enough for a martini, but I imagine that might be what you might order now.
Yeah.
And what did you say? Now, I've heard you talk about Ben over the years, and I have never had the pleasure to meet him, but what did you say he does again? He's a firefighter, right?
He's a firefighter. He got a biology degree and went out to California from Michigan and hooked up with a big animal training school and mm-hmm. became a tiger trainer at first. And he worked
That's
at a park
nuts.
Outside of San Francisco. And, I mean, he's 6'5". He's a big guy. And he's got scars. And we have pictures. Agatha and I have pictures of us petting tiger cubs.
Wow.
When he was still doing it. And then he got, there was something going on with, it was Marine World. It was right outside of San Francisco. And something was going on. It got sold. And he decided he was going to become a
fireman.
A firefighter.
Where is he now?
In Oakland.
In Oakland. Oh, so he stayed in the Bay Area.
Yeah. Yeah. He's in, I don't know if he's an engineer now, but he drives and he plateaued on purpose because he said he didn't want the responsibility of being in charge of people.
Oh, yeah. I don't blame him on that one.
But he lives a pretty good life.
That's awesome. Well, I love that story so much. And I love your next story, too. So if you want to get ready to read it, that would be amazing.
All right.
This one's
called The Boulder. I got up at 3 a.m., walked into a taxi at 3:45 a.m., went through check-in and security, grabbed a coffee, and flew to meet my family, who was already in the dusty surf town on the Pacific coast of Baja, California. My wife and two daughters had been there for a week, staying with my mother in the casita. The flight was uneventful, mostly about the amount of clothes and odds and ends I was bringing for the casita or the girls to keep us all entertained. It is interesting the lasting power of Sammy Hagar and the people who enjoy going to Cabo still emulating him and his style. The San Jose del Cabo Airport has changed dramatically in the last 5 years. Before that, it was essentially two warehouses that had very little to purchase outside of tequila and some strange knickknacks. It was quite different from the impression one gets from all the tourist advertisements you saw in the U.S. As an aside, the trips home were always long lines from one slow-moving security check-in combination. The security was meticulous and slow, going through every item in your bag on a table, much like a gurney. With two little girls and a wife terrified of flying, this was pretty close to waiting in line for hell. But arriving was easy. I got off, grabbed my overstuffed bag, went through customs in a flash, and then sent it off to people offering me a ride, saying, "No ya va con mama," which is seemingly correct, though an odd thing to say to a taxi driver or probably to anyone. But I got through and found my mom. My mother is 6'1", semi-fluent in Spanish, and is about to be 80. This was a few years ago, and the only thing that has changed in that is the amount of gray that she allows to show through her now dyed but formerly jet black hair. Emotional, a rock, and perhaps the smartest person I know, she led me to her dusty Subaru, tacos, and beer. The drive has improved, but only in the last 5 or 6 years. Then, what is now a 90-minute drive could take 5 hours. Long, winding dirt highway, often washed out, which meant you had veered into the desert to get around the pits. Not a drive for night. My mother calmly drove the entire way. The coast is beautiful with arroyos, the outcroppings of rocks, sandy beaches, and cactus. The tacos. I'm a stupid gringo who loves tacos. The village is filled with expats from Canada, Australia, and the U.S., mostly widowers in their 70s. I think the Mexicans must find it very strange, but the village does a very good job at attempting to commingle. Often there are community events with gringos, and Mexicans alike sharing, laughing, eating, and sometimes dancing. The town is dusty, hot, and proof that the United States does things differently, not necessarily better. I love it. We arrived at the casita. Hugs, kisses, my kids, my wife. A nice change from travel that started at 3 a.m. Eastern time. It was announced that dinner was down the block at my mother's Mexican friend's cafe in the courtyard of a strange, nondescript hotel that was always seemed forgotten and made for something else. She was throwing a party for my arrival. Awkward and extremely kind, and I've been to this desert surfing town many times now. My mother and father first started going in 1995 or 96. I first went in 2008 and have almost every year since. The memories blur. What I remember about this trip is a theme that started that night at that party that permeated the next 10 days. It was awkward as hell, surreal, and friendly. There were only a few of us, a couple who had also played acoustic folk rock, wonderful people, but I didn't know them. And they were also hired and guests. the Mexican proprietor and coffee roaster, my mother, my family, and a Canadian-Australian lost soul of a young woman. So we ate on paper plates some good food and had some tequila. And the couple played and sang to my wife and I and the kids, my mother, the owner of the cafe, and the woman who spent the entire time doing yoga. Oh, and my eldest daughter, maybe 8 at the time, ran the courtyard half wall while we hoped she didn't fall. It was wonderfully odd, sleep deprived, and so well meant I almost feel bad laughing about it. But that is my mother, and that is that town, dusty, full of widowed gringos, Toyota trucks, sand rails, and tequila. And just so you understand what I mean, our last day on the beach, it was unusually cold. Our friends were body surfing in wetsuits. Another friend, a formerly famous movie and TV star, was sitting nearby arguing with her much younger on-again, off-again Mexican boyfriend, her dog barking like mad at everything, the girls working on their final sandcastle, when an old man came trudging along the beach. He had been walking from the more tourist side, but was showing no signs of slowing down, though he wasn't moving fast because he was carrying a small boulder the size of a basketball, with purpose. Why? We decided he was an assassin. What else could he be? His target, further down and unsuspecting, was going to have that rock dropped on him or her. Why didn't matter? The lover's quarrel, the dog, and the tourists throwing their frisbees, kicking the balls, the people selling their wares. No one stopped to notice the old man. Incognito. My wife and I watched as he slowly worked through the crowded beach chaos and disappeared down the way. We clinked our beers, looked out at the Pacific, still aptly named.
Muitas vezes o coração não consegue compreender. Que a mente não faz questão, nem tem forças pra obedecer. Quantos sonhos já destruí e deixei escapar das mãos. Se o futuro assim permitir, não pretendo viver em vão. Meu amor, não estamos sós, tem um mundo a esperar por nós. No infinito do céu azul, pode ter vida em Marte, então vem cá, me dá sua língua. Então vem, que quero abraçar você. Seu poder vem do sol, minha medida, meu bem. Vamos viver a vida. Então vem, senão eu vou perder quem sou. Vou querer me mudar para uma life on Mars.
I love, love, love that Bowie cover, I have to say. I also really enjoyed hearing Freddie the Cat in the background in the beginning.
Oh my God, he started attacking me. It's like, where did it come from? Out of nowhere. Which is perfect, which is why I wanted that song, because we joked that going there to Todos Santos is kind of like living in a Wes Anderson movie.
Oh, I can picture it so well. And although you say that it was an awkward party, it sounds like such a beautiful moment between you and Agatha, like laughing about the guy with the boulder and making up this story that he's an assassin. And just like, I can see it. Agatha's got a wicked sense of humor. Very creative woman, as are you as well. That's a really beautiful story. It's really descriptive.
Oh, thanks.
It shows that, you know, it's a town that I've wanted to come visit you guys at for so many years, and so I have my own ideas of what it is, but to hear you describe it so beautifully, and to hear, like, the reference of, like, Sammy Hagar and the Cabo Wabo and all that.
Like, those people are amazing.
I have another...
I mean, they get on the plane, and they're already in their weird little tight neon shorts and...
Oh my God, I can just imagine it. I have a friend here on the island who talks about Cabo back in the day, probably like around the time that your mom first started going, even earlier than that. And just, she talks about how different it was. And she was there at the opening of Cabo Wabo. And just to hear the stories is so funny. I can imagine. Yeah. That, I'd like to see that area. One day, FL, I'm going to meet you there.
Yeah, we'll all go.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, I have one little story to read myself, and then we're just going to close out the show. So are you going to stay with us? You are, right?
I'm going to stay.
Great. All right, beautiful. The summer of my junior year of high school was in 1989. My father had passed away the previous March, and I was collecting his Social Security, which for me was an astonishing amount of money, although he would not have thought so. I had to sit in a Social Security office on California Avenue in Chicago, in Logan Square, for hours to apply. I sat there alone with predominantly Hispanic elders and impatiently waited for my number to be called. Slowly, one by one, people would shuffle up to the plexiglass windows that protected the government workers. Papers would slide under the window in the designated slot. The sunlight in the room would shift as the hours went on. It was a room that was filled with chairs that were reminiscent of old wooden school chairs, upright and rigid. I did not like being there. By the time the checks arrived, it was early summer and school was almost out, so I bought a ticket for Amsterdam with my best friend Sarah, who came with me. She was a few years older. She had a curvy little figure and long, black, wavy hair. We made a great team for traveling. Still do. Amsterdam was the first place we would land. We spent time in the obligatory pot cafes, smoking and drinking, walked through the red light district, and even got chased by a gang of youth. But ultimately, we would find a political squat and spend time there, reading angsty graffiti on the walls and meeting and philosophizing with the locals. It was amazing. But really, I wanted to make our way to Berlin. The thing about Berlin was that it was 1989, and no one, well, mostly probably just me, didn't know the wall was going to come down that November. As far as I knew, Checkpoint Charlie was intact. I had been an exchange student with a girl from Berlin the year before, and she invited us to come. Having grown up in a Polish-Puerto Rican neighborhood, I knew about World War II. I had seen firsthand the tattoos on the arms of people who survived the war and would later sit on porch stoops in the United States smoking cigarettes, not wanting to talk about it, but not wanting to talk about it either. I grew up with a girl named Diana Ortiz. Her mom was Polish, Vivian, and her dad was Mexican, super common for where I grew up. Vivian was an amazing cook. She had no idea how much her cooking meant to me at that time. I would sit in her garden-level apartment and eat bowl after bowl of chicken noodle soup and pork chops with applesauce. But it is Busha for who I am referring to. She had been in a concentration camp and got out, intact with tattoos and her daughter Vivian. She had been a cook there. Their house was two doors down from me. The first day I met Diana, I had on an Ozzy Osbourne t-shirt, and she saw me and said, "Hey," and cocked her head. She liked heavy metal. I did the same. We were like nine, and I knew that we would be friends. She and I would smoke early morning cigarettes before school in the basement of my house, a defunct funeral home built in the 1920s, yellow brick with rose-colored windows. Inside was my eccentric father, who always had classical music playing quite loudly. I often would visit Busha. I loved to spend time with her. She had a full head of gray hair high on her head, sunken in cheeks, and so many missing teeth. My favorite memory of her was visiting her upstairs apartment of a three-story brownstone and opening the door onto one of these bedrooms and seeing two single beds, each one completely filled with at least five cats per bed. Many of them were white and sprawled out so beautifully. I remember thinking, "Whoa, what? This is amazing." I often think of Busha. She was such a part of what formed me. So much. She was there when I made my first communion and my first confirmation. The church was, after all, called St. Hedwig's, with stained glass etched in Polish, a place I always go back to. My mind buzzed with excitement of years past in that basement of the school where all the bazaars would be held. All the women of the church would bake their finest coffee cakes or kolachki and sell them for pennies. Berlin was a symbol of so many negative and positive things for people like her. And to be there the summer before the wall came down was truly remarkable. I remember sitting in my classroom of St. Hedwig's and having had to read so much about World War II, looking out onto the window onto Webster Avenue. Berlin was a place. It was a place where I would walk around and see history and feel history in a way that I knew from my block in Chicago. The city buzzed in that fabulous way only they can do in summer. Hot, sweaty people walking fast. Late nights in clubs. Kreuzberg was the area to be in. It was like the wild, wild west, and the streets seemed to be laden with hashish and excitement. We did, of course, go to East Berlin, walking with my headphones with David Bowie playing loudly into my ears. It was an irreplaceable feeling to be there that summer. I did go home and went back to school, and the wall would come down, and I did touch it. I had wished I had been there when it came down, the symbol of final freedom. Thank you so much, FL, and thank you to the voice of Vashon. I'm glad you came on and had fun. It would have only been better if you would have been here in the studio with me.
That would have been great.
I know.
Someday.
Yeah. Well, we miss you and love you, and give Agatha a big hug and kiss.
Hi to everyone on Vashon.
Absolutely. Love you too. This has been the Cats and Jammer Follies, and I'm Megan Hastings. And please join us again next week for another couple of tales of travel.
I've been everywhere.